Silent and motionless, the spiritual atmosphere of the classroom is damp and chilly. Back in 1859, the desire of mill owners in the town of Lowell that their workers be educated was explained by the secretary of the Massachusetts Board of Education. The owners of factories are more concerned than other classes and interests in the intelligence of their laborers. When the latter are well educated and the former are disposed to deal justly, controversies and strikes can never occur, nor can the minds of the masses be prejudiced by demagogues and controlled by temporary and factious considerations. Joel Spring, in his book Education and the Rise of the Corporate State, says, "The development of a factory-like system in the 19th century schoolroom was not accidental. This continued into the 20th century, when William Bagley's Classroom Management became a standard teacher training text reprinted 30 times. Bagley said, "One who studies educational theory aright can see in the mechanical routine of the classroom the educative forces that are slowly transforming the child from a little savage into a creature of law and order, fit for the life of civilized society." It was in the middle and late 19th century that high schools developed as aids to the industrial system, that history was widely required in the curriculum to foster patriotism. Loyalty oaths, teacher certification, and the requirement of citizenship were introduced to control both the educational and the political quality of teachers. Also, in the latter part of the century, school officials, not teachers, were given control over textbooks. Laws passed by the states barred certain kinds of textbooks. Idaho and Montana, for instance, forbade textbooks propagating political doctrines, and the Dakota Territory ruled that school libraries could not have partisan political pamphlets or books. Against this gigantic organization of knowledge and education for orthodoxy and obedience, there arose a literature of dissent and protest, which had to make its way from reader to reader against great obstacles. Henry George, a self-educated working man from a poor Philadelphia family, who became a newspaper man and an economist, wrote a book that was published in 1879 and sold millions of copies, not only in the United States, but all over the world. His book, Progress and Poverty, argued that the basis of wealth was land, that this was becoming monopolized, and that a single tax on land, abolishing all others, would bring enough revenue to solve the problem of poverty and equalize wealth in the nation. Readers may not have been persuaded of his solutions, but they could see in their own lives the accuracy of his observations. It is true that wealth has been greatly increased, and that the average of comfort, leisure, and refinement has been raised. But these gains are not general. In them the lowest class do not share. This association of poverty with progress is the great enigma of our times. There is a vague but general feeling of disappointment, an increased bitterness among the working classes, a widespread feeling of unrest and brooding revolution. The civilized world is trembling on the verge of a great movement. Either it must be a leap upward, which will open the way to advances yet undreamed of, or it must be a plunge downward, which will carry us back toward barbarism. A different kind of challenge to the economic and social system was given by Edward Bellamy, a lawyer and writer from Western Massachusetts, who wrote in simple, intriguing language a novel called Looking Backward, in which the author falls asleep and wakes up in the year 2000 to find a socialistic society in which people work and live cooperatively. Looking Backward, which describes socialism vividly, lovingly, sold a million copies in a few years, and over 100 groups were organized around the country to try to make the dream come true. It seemed that despite the strenuous efforts of government, business, the church, the schools, to control their thinking, millions of Americans were ready to consider harsh criticism of the existing system, to contemplate other possible ways of living. They were helped in this by the great movements of workers and farmers that swept the country in the 1880s and 1890s. These movements went beyond the scattered strikes and tenant struggles of the period 1830 to 1877. They were nationwide movements, more threatening than before to the ruling elite, more dangerously suggestive. It was a time when revolutionary organizations existed in major American cities, and revolutionary talk was in the air. In the 1880s and 1890s, immigrants were pouring in from Europe at a faster rate than before. They all went through the harrowing ocean voyage of the poor. Now there were not so many Irish and German immigrants as Italians, Russians, Jews, Greeks, people from Southern and Eastern Europe, even more alien to native-born Anglo-Saxons than the earlier newcomers. How the immigration of different ethnic groups contributed to the fragmentation of the working class, how conflicts developed among groups facing the same difficult conditions, is shown in an article in a Bohemian newspaper, Svornost, of February 27, 1880. A petition of 258 parents and guardians at the Throop School in New York, signed by over half the taxpayers of the school district, said, "The petitioners have just as much right to request the teaching of Bohemian as have the German citizens to have German taught in the public schools. In opposition to this, Mr. Volk claims that there is a great deal of difference between Germans and Bohemians, or, in other words, they are superior." The Irish, still recalling the hatred against them when they arrived, began to get jobs with the new political machines that wanted their vote. Those who became policemen encountered the new Jewish immigrants. On July 30, 1902, New York's Jewish community held a mass funeral for an important rabbi, and a riot took place, led by Irish who resented Jews coming into their neighborhood. The police force was dominantly Irish, and the official investigation of the riot indicated the police helped the rioters. It appears that charges of unprovoked and most brutal clubbing had been made against policemen, with the result that they were reprimanded or fined a day's pay and were yet retained upon the force. There was desperate economic competition among the newcomers. By 1880, Chinese immigrants brought in by the railroads to do the backbreaking labor at pitiful wages numbered 75,000 in California, almost one-tenth of the population. They became the objects of continuous violence. The novelist Bret Harte wrote an obituary for a Chinese man named Wan Li. "Dead, my revered friends, dead. Stoned to death in the streets of San Francisco in the year of grace 1869 by a mob of half-grown boys and Christian school children." In Rock Springs, Wyoming, in the summer of 1885, whites attacked 500 Chinese miners, massacring 28 of them in cold blood. The new immigrants became laborers, house painters, stone cutters, ditch diggers. They were often imported en masse by contractors. One Italian man, told he was going to Connecticut to work on the railroad, was taken instead to sulfite mines in the south, where he and his fellows were watched over by armed guards in their barracks and in the mines, given only enough money to pay for their railroad fare and tools, and very little to eat. He and others decided to escape. They were captured at gunpoint, ordered to work or die. They still refused and were brought before a judge, put in manacles, and 5 months after their arrival, finally dismissed. "My comrades took the train for New York. I had only $1, and with this, not knowing either the country or the language, I had to walk to New York. After 42 days, I arrived in the city, utterly exhausted." Their conditions led sometimes to rebellion. A contemporary observer told how some Italians who worked in a locality near Deal Lake, New Jersey, failing to receive their wages, captured the contractor and shut him up in the shanty, where he remained a prisoner until the county sheriff came with a posse to his rescue. A traffic in immigrant child laborers developed, either by contract with desperate parents in the home country or by kidnapping. The children were then supervised by padrones in the form of slavery, sometimes sent out as beggar musicians. Droves of them roamed the streets of New York and Philadelphia. As the immigrants became naturalized citizens, they were brought into the American two-party system, invited to be loyal to one party or the other, their political energy thus siphoned into elections. An article in L'Italia in November 1894 called for Italians to support the Republican Party. When American citizens of foreign birth refuse to ally themselves with the Republican Party, they make war upon their own welfare. The Republican Party stands for all that the people fight for in the old world. It is the champion of freedom, progress, order, and law. It is the steadfast foe of monarchical class rule. There were 5.5 million immigrants in the 1840s, 4 million in the 1890s, creating a labor surplus that kept wages down. The immigrants were more controllable, more helpless than native workers. They were culturally displaced, at odds with one another, therefore useful as strikebreakers. Often their children worked, intensifying the problem of an oversized labor force and joblessness. In 1880, there were 1,118,000 children under 16, one out of six, at work in the United States. With everyone working long hours, families often became strangers to one another. A pants presser named Morris Rosenfeld wrote a poem, My Boy, which became widely reprinted and recited. I have a little boy at home, a pretty little son. I think sometimes the world is mine, in him my only one. Ere dawn my labor drives me forth, 'tis night when I am free. A stranger am I to my child, and stranger my child to me. Women immigrants became servants, prostitutes, housewives, factory workers, and sometimes rebels. Leonora Barry was born in Ireland and brought to the United States. She got married, and when her husband died, she went to work in a hosiery mill in upstate New York to support three young children, earning 65 cents her first week. She joined the Knights of Labor, which had 50,000 women members in 192 women's assemblies by 1886. She became master workman of her assembly of 927 women, and was appointed to work for the Knights as a general investigator, to go forth and educate her sister working women and the public generally as to their needs and necessities. She described the biggest problem of women workers. Through long years of endurance, they have acquired, as a sort of second nature, the habit of submission and acceptance, without question, of any terms offered them, with a pessimistic view of life in which they see no hope. Her report for the year 1888 showed 537 requests to help women organize, 100 cities and towns visited, 1,900 leaflets distributed. In 1884, women's assemblies of textile workers and hatmakers went on strike. The following year in New York, cloak and shirt makers, men and women, holding separate meetings but acting together, went on strike. The New York World called it a revolt for bread and butter. They won higher wages and shorter hours. That winter in Yonkers, a few women carpet weavers were fired for joining the Knights, and in the cold of February, 2,500 women walked out and picketed the mill. Only 700 of them were members of the Knights, but all the strikers soon joined. The police attacked the picket line and arrested them, but a jury found them not guilty. A great dinner was held by working people in New York to honor them, with 2,000 delegates from unions all over the city. The strike lasted 6 months, and the women won some of their demands, getting back their jobs, but without recognition of their union. What was astonishing in so many of these struggles was not that the strikers did not win all that they wanted, but that against such great odds they dared to resist and were not destroyed. Perhaps it was the recognition that day-to-day combat was not enough, that fundamental change was needed, which stimulated the growth of revolutionary movements at this time. The Socialist Labor Party, formed in 1877, was tiny and torn by internal arguments, but it had some influence in organizing unions among foreign workers. In New York, Jewish socialists organized and put out a newspaper. In Chicago, German revolutionaries, along with native-born radicals like Albert Parsons, formed social revolutionary clubs. In 1883, an anarchist congress took place in Pittsburgh. It drew up a manifesto. All laws are directed against the working people. Even the school serves only the purpose of furnishing the offspring of the wealthy with those qualities necessary to uphold their class domination. The children of the poor get scarcely a formal elementary training, and this, too, is mainly directed to such branches as tend to producing prejudices, arrogance, and servility. In short, want of sense. The church, finally, seeks to make complete idiots out of the mass and to make them forego the paradise on earth by promising a fictitious heaven. The capitalist press, on the other hand, takes care of the confusion of spirits in public life. The workers can therefore expect no help from any capitalistic party in their struggle against the existing system. They must achieve their liberation by their own efforts. As in former times, a privileged class never surrenders its tyranny. Neither can it be expected that the capitalists of this age will give up their rulership without being forced to do it. The manifesto asked equal rights for all without distinction to sex or race. It quoted the Communist Manifesto, "Workmen of all lands, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. You have a world to win." In Chicago, the New International Working People's Association had 5,000 members, published newspapers in 5 languages, organized mass demonstrations and parades, and through its leadership and strikes, was a powerful influence in the 22 unions that made up the Central Labor Union of Chicago. There were differences in theory among all these revolutionary groups, but the theorists were often brought together by the practical needs of labor struggles, and there were many in the mid-1880s. In early 1886, the Texas and Pacific Railroad fired a leader of the District Assembly of the Knights of Labor, and this led to a strike which spread throughout the Southwest, tying up traffic as far as St. Louis and Kansas City. 9 young men recruited in New Orleans as marshals, brought to Texas to protect company property, learned about the strike and quit their jobs, saying, "As man to man, we could not justifiably go to work and take the bread out of our fellow workmen's mouths, no matter how much we needed it ourselves." They were then arrested for defrauding the company by refusing to work and sentenced to 3 months in the Galveston County Jail. The strikers engaged in sabotage. A news dispatch from Atchison, Kansas. At 12:45 this morning, the men on guard at the Missouri Pacific Roundhouse were surprised by the appearance of 35 to 40 masked men. The guards were corralled in the oil room by a detachment of the visitors who stood guard with pistols, while the rest of them thoroughly disabled 12 locomotives which stood in the stalls. In April, in East St. Louis, there was a battle between strikers and police. 7 workingmen were killed, whereupon workers burned the freight depot of the Louisville and Nashville. The governor declared martial law and sent in 700 National Guardsmen. With mass arrests, violent attacks by sheriffs and deputies, no support from the skilled, better-paid workers of the railway brotherhoods, the strikers could not hold out. After several months, they surrendered, and many of them were blacklisted. By the spring of 1886, The movement for an 8-hour day had grown. On May 1, the American Federation of Labor, now 5 years old, called for nationwide strikes wherever the 8-hour day was refused. Terence Powderly, head of the Knights of Labor, opposed the strike, saying that employers and employees must first be educated on the 8-hour day. But assemblies of the Knights made plans to strike. The Grand Chief of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers opposed the 8-hour day, saying, 2 hours less work means 2 hours more loafing about the corners and 2 hours more for drink. But railroad workers did not agree and supported the 8-hour movement. So, 350,000 workers in 11,562 establishments all over the country went out on strike. In Detroit, 11,000 workers marched in an 8-hour parade. In New York, 25,000 formed a torchlight procession along Broadway, headed by 3,400 members of the Bakers Union. In Chicago, 40,000 struck, and 45,000 were granted a shorter working day to prevent them from striking. Every railroad in Chicago stopped running, and most of the industries in Chicago were paralyzed. The stockyards were closed down. A citizens' committee of businessmen met daily to map strategy in Chicago. The state militia had been called out, the police were ready, and the Chicago Mail on May 1 asked that Albert Parsons and August Spies, the anarchist leaders of the International Working People's Association, be watched. Keep them in view. Hold them personally responsible for any trouble that occurs. Make an example of them if trouble occurs. Under the leadership of Parsons and Spies, the Central Labor Union, with 22 unions, had adopted a fiery resolution in the fall of 1885. Be it resolved that we urgently call upon the wage-earning class to arm itself in order to be able to put forth against their exploiters such an argument which alone can be effective. Violence, and further be it resolved that notwithstanding that we expect very little from the introduction of the 8-hour day, we firmly promise to assist our more backward brethren in this class struggle with all means and power at our disposal, so long as they will continue to show an open and resolute front to our common oppressors, the aristocratic vagabonds and exploiters. Our war cry is death to the foes of the human race. On May 3rd, a series of events took place which were to put Parsons and Spies in exactly the position that the Chicago Mail had suggested. Make an example of them if trouble occurs. That day, in front of the McCormick Harvester Works, where strikers and sympathizers fought scabs, the police fired into a crowd of strikers running from the scene, wounded many of them, and killed four. Spies, enraged, went to the printing shop of the Arbeiter Zeitung and printed a circular in both English and German. Revenge, working men, to arms! You have for years endured the most abject humiliations. You have worked yourself to death. Your children you have sacrificed to the factory lord. In short, you have been miserable and obedient slaves all these years. Why? To satisfy the insatiable greed, to fill the coffers of your lazy, thieving master? When you ask them now to lessen your burdens, he sends his bloodhounds out to shoot you, kill you. To arms! We call you to arms! A meeting was called for Haymarket Square on the evening of May 4th, and about 3,000 persons assembled. It was a quiet meeting, and as storm clouds gathered and the hour grew late, the crowd dwindled to a few hundred. A detachment of 180 policemen showed up, advanced on the speaker's platform, ordered the crowd to disperse. The speaker said the meeting was almost over. A bomb then exploded in the midst of the police, wounding 66 policemen, of whom 7 later died. The police fired into the crowd, killing several people, wounding 200. With no evidence on who threw the bomb, the police arrested 8 anarchist leaders in Chicago. The Chicago Journal said, "Justice should be prompt in dealing with the arrested anarchists. The law regarding accessories to crime in this state is so plain that their trials will be short." Illinois law said that anyone inciting a murder was guilty of that murder. The evidence against the 8 anarchists was their ideas, their literature. None had been at Haymarket that day except Fielden, who was speaking when the bomb exploded. A jury found them guilty, and they were sentenced to death. Their appeals were denied. The Supreme Court said it had no jurisdiction. The event aroused international excitement. Meetings took place in France, Holland, Russia, Italy, Spain. In London, a meeting of protest was sponsored by George Bernard Shaw, William Morris, and Peter Kropotkin, among others. Shaw had responded in his characteristic way to the turning down of an appeal by the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court. If the world must lose 8 of its people, it can better afford to lose the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court. A year after the trial, 4 of the convicted anarchists, Albert Parsons, a printer, August Spies, an upholsterer, Adolf Fischer, and George Engel, were hanged. Louis Ling, a 21-year-old carpenter, blew himself up in his cell by exploding a dynamite tube in his mouth. 3 remained in prison. The executions aroused people all over the country. There was a funeral march of 25,000 in Chicago. Some evidence came out that a man named Rudolf Schnaubelt, supposedly an anarchist, was actually an agent of the police, an agent provocateur, hired to throw the bomb and thus enable the arrest of hundreds, the destruction of the revolutionary leadership in Chicago. But to this day, it has not been discovered who threw the bomb. While the immediate result was a suppression of the radical movement, the long-term effect was to keep alive the class anger of many, to inspire others, especially young people of that generation, to action in revolutionary causes. 60,000 signed petitions to the new governor of Illinois, John Peter Altgeld, who investigated the facts, denounced what had happened, and pardoned the 3 remaining prisoners. Year after year, all over the country, memorial meetings for the Haymarket martyrs were held. It is impossible to know the number of individuals whose political awakening, as with Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, long-time revolutionary stalwarts of the next generation, came from the Haymarket affair. As late as 1968, the Haymarket events were alive. In that year, a group of young radicals in Chicago blew up the monument that had been erected to the memory of the police who died in the explosion. And the trial of 8 leaders of the anti-war movement in Chicago around that time evoked in the press, in meetings, and in literature the memory of the first Chicago 8 on trial for their ideas. After Haymarket, class conflict and violence continued with strikes, lockouts, blacklisting, the use of Pinkerton detectives and police to break strikes with force, and courts to break them by law. During a strike of streetcar conductors on the 3rd Avenue line in New York, a month after the Haymarket affair, police charged a crowd of thousands using their clubs indiscriminately. The New York Sun reported, "Men with broken scalps were crawling off in all directions." Some of the energy of resentment in late 1886 was poured into the electoral campaign for mayor of New York that fall. Trade unions formed an independent labor party and nominated for mayor Henry George, the radical economist, whose Progress and Poverty had been read by tens of thousands of workers. George's platform tells something about the conditions of life for workers in New York in the 1880s. It demanded, 1. That property qualifications be abolished for members of juries. 2. That grand jurors be chosen from the lower class as well as from the upper class, which dominated grand juries. 3. That the police not interfere with peaceful meetings. 4. That the sanitary inspection of buildings be enforced. 5. That contract labor be abolished in public works. 6. That there be equal pay for equal work for women. 7. That the streetcars be owned by the municipal government. The Democrats nominated an iron manufacturer, Abram Hewitt, and the Republicans nominated Theodore Roosevelt at a convention presided over by Elihu Root, a corporation lawyer, with the nominating speech given by Chauncey Depew, a railroad director. In a campaign of coercion and bribery, Hewitt was elected with 41% of the vote. George came second with 31% of the vote, and Roosevelt third with 27% of the vote. The New York World saw this as a signal. The deep-voiced protest conveyed in the 67,000 votes for Henry George against the combined power of both political parties, of Wall Street and the business interests, and of the public press, should be a warning to the community to heed the demands of labor so far as they are just and reasonable. In other cities in the country, too, labor candidates ran, polling 25,000 out of 92,000 votes in Chicago, electing a mayor in Milwaukee, and various local officials in Fort Worth, Texas, Eaton, Ohio, and Leadville, Colorado. It seemed that the weight of Haymarket had not crushed the labor movement. The year 1886 became known to contemporaries as the year of the great uprising of labor. From 1881 to 1885, strikes had averaged about 500 each year, involving perhaps 150,000 workers each year. In 1886, there were over 1,400 strikes involving 500,000 workers. John Commons, in his History of the Labor Movement in the United States, saw in that the signs of a great movement by the class of the unskilled, which had finally risen in rebellion. The movement bore in every way the aspect of a social war. A frenzied hatred of labor for capital was shown in every important strike. Extreme bitterness toward capital manifested itself in all the actions of the Knights of Labor, and wherever the leaders undertook to hold it within bounds, they were generally discarded by their followers. Even among Southern blacks, where all the military, political, and economic force of the Southern states, with the acquiescence of the national government, was concentrated on keeping them docile and working, there were sporadic rebellions. In the cotton fields, blacks were dispersed in their work, but in the sugar fields, work was done in gangs, so there was opportunity for organized action. In 1880, they had struck to get a dollar a day instead of 75 cents, threatening to leave the state. Strikers were arrested and jailed, but they walked the roads along the sugar fields carrying banners, "A dollar a day or Kansas." They were arrested again and again for trespassing, and the strike was broken. By 1886, however, the Knights of Labor was organizing in the sugar fields. In the peak year of the Knights' influence, the black workers, unable to feed and clothe their families on their wages, often paid in store scrip, asked a dollar a day once more. The following year in the fall, close to 10,000 sugar laborers went on strike, 90% of them Negroes and members of the Knights. The militia arrived and gun battles began. Violence erupted in the town of Thibodeau, which had become a kind of refugee village where hundreds of strikers, evicted from their plantation shacks, gathered, penniless and ragged, carrying their bed clothing and babies. Their refusal to work threatened the entire sugar crop, and martial law was declared in Thibodeau. Henry and George Cox, two Negro brothers, leaders in the Knights of Labor, were arrested, locked up, then taken from their cells and never heard from again. On the night of November 22nd, shooting broke out, each side claiming the other was at fault. By noon the next day, 30 Negroes were dead or dying and hundreds wounded. Two whites were wounded. A Negro newspaper in New Orleans wrote, "Lame men and blind women shot. Children and hoary-headed grandsires ruthlessly swept down. The Negroes offered no resistance. They could not, as the killing was unexpected. Those of them not killed took to the woods, a majority of them finding refuge in this city. Citizens of the United States killed by a mob directed by a state judge. Laboring men seeking an advance in wages treated as if they were dogs. At such times and upon such occasions, words of condemnation fall like snowflakes upon molten lead. The blacks should defend their lives, and if needs, must die. Die with their faces toward their persecutors, fighting for their homes, their children, and their lawful rights." Native-born poor whites were not doing well either. In the South, they were tenant farmers rather than landowners. In the southern cities, they were tenants, not homeowners. C. Van Woodward notes, Origins of the New South, that the city with the highest rate of tenancy in the United States was Birmingham, with 90%. And the slums of the southern cities were among the worst, poor whites living like the blacks, on unpaved dirt streets, choked up with garbage, filth, and mud, according to a report of one state board of health. There were eruptions against the convict labor system in the South, in which prisoners were leased in slave labor to corporations, used thus to depress the general level of wages, and also to break strikes. In the year 1891, miners of the Tennessee Coal Mine Company were asked to sign an ironclad contract, pledging no strikes, agreeing to get paid in scrip, and giving up the right to check the weight of the coal they mined. They were paid by the weight. They refused to sign and were evicted from their houses. Convicts were brought in to replace them. On the night of October 31st, 1891, 1,000 armed miners took control of the mine area, set 500 convicts free, and burned down the stockades in which the convicts were kept. The companies surrendered, agreeing not to use convicts, not to require the ironclad contract, and to let the miners check on the weight of the coal they mined. The following year, there were more such incidents in Tennessee. C. Van Woodward calls them insurrections. Miners overpowered guards of the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company, burned the stockades, shipped the convicts to Nashville. Other unions in Tennessee came to their aid. An observer reported back to the Chattanooga Federation of Trades. "I should like to impress upon people the extent of this movement. I have seen the written assurance of reinforcements to the miners of fully 7,500 men who will be on the field in 10 hours after the first shot is fired. The entire district is as one over the main proposition. The convicts must go. I counted 840 rifles on Monday as the miners passed, while the vast multitude following them carried revolvers. The captains of the different companies are all Grand Army men. Whites and Negroes are standing shoulder to shoulder." That same year in New Orleans, 42 Union locals, with over 20,000 members, mostly white but including some blacks, there was one black on the strike committee, called a general strike involving the population of the city. Work in New Orleans came to a stop. After 3 days, with strikebreakers brought in, martial law, and the threat of militia, the strike ended with a compromise, gaining hours and wages, but without recognition of the unions as bargaining agents. The year 1892 saw strike struggles all over the country. Besides the general strike in New Orleans and the coal miners' strike in Tennessee, there was a railroad switchman's strike in Buffalo, New York, and a copper miner strike in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. The Coeur d'Alene strike was marked by gun battles between strikers and strike breakers, and many deaths. A newspaper account of July 11, 1892 reported, "The long-dreaded conflict between the forces of the strikers and the non-union men who have taken their places has come at last. As a result, 5 men are known to be dead and 16 are already in the hospital. The Frisco Mill on Canyon Creek is in ruins. The Gem Mine has surrendered to the strikers. The arms of its employees have been captured, and the employees themselves have been ordered out of the country. Flushed with the success of these victories, the turbulent element among the strikers are preparing to move upon other strongholds of the non-union men. The National Guard, brought in by the governor, was reinforced by federal troops. 600 miners were rounded up and imprisoned in bullpens, scabs brought back, union leaders fired, the strike broken. In early 1892, the Carnegie Steel Plant in Homestead, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, was being managed by Henry Clay Frick while Carnegie was in Europe. Frick decided to reduce the workers' wages and break their union. He built a fence 3 miles long and 12 feet high around the steelworks and topped it with barbed wire, adding peepholes for rifles. When the workers did not accept the pay cut, Frick laid off the entire workforce. The Pinkerton Detective Agency was hired to protect strikebreakers. Although only 750 of the 3,800 workers at Homestead belonged to the union, 3,000 workers met in the Opera House and voted overwhelmingly to strike. The plant was on the Monongahela River, and 1,000 pickets began patrolling a 10-mile stretch of the river. A committee of strikers took over the town, and the sheriff was unable to raise a posse among local people against them. On the night of July 5th, 1892, hundreds of Pinkerton guards boarded barges 5 miles down the river from Homestead and moved toward the plant, where 10,000 strikers and sympathizers waited. The crowd warned the Pinkertons not to step off the barge. A striker lay down on the gangplank, and when a Pinkerton man tried to shove him aside, he fired, wounding the detective in the thigh. In the gunfire that followed on both sides, 7 workers were killed. The Pinkertons had to retreat onto the barges. They were attacked from all sides, voted to surrender, and then were beaten by the enraged crowd. There were dead on both sides. For the next several days, the strikers were in command of the area. Now the state went into action. The governor brought in the militia, armed with the latest rifles and Gatling guns, to protect the import of strikebreakers. Strike leaders were charged with murder. 160 other strikers were tried for other crimes. All were acquitted by friendly juries. The entire strike committee was then arrested for treason against the state, but no jury would convict them. The strike held for 4 months, but the plant was producing steel with strikebreakers who were brought in, often in locked trains, not knowing their destination, not knowing a strike was on. The strikers, with no resources left, agreed to return to work, their leaders blacklisted. One reason for the defeat was that the strike was confined to Homestead, and other plants of Carnegie kept working. Some blast furnace workers did strike, but they were quickly defeated, and the pig iron from those furnaces was then used at Homestead. The defeat kept unionization from the Carnegie plants well into the 20th century, and the workers took wage cuts and increases in hours without organized resistance. In the midst of the Homestead strike, a young anarchist from New York named Alexander Berkman, in a plan prepared by anarchist friends in New York, including his lover, Emma Goldman, came to Pittsburgh and entered the office of Henry Clay Frick, determined to kill him. Berkman's aim was poor. He wounded Frick and was overwhelmed, then was tried and found guilty of attempted murder. He served 14 years in the state penitentiary. His Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist gave a graphic description of the assassination attempt and of his years in prison when he changed his mind about the usefulness of assassinations, but remained a dedicated revolutionary. Emma Goldman's autobiography, Living My Life, conveys the anger, the sense of injustice, the desire for a new kind of life that grew among the young radicals of that day. The year 1893 saw the biggest economic crisis in the country's history. After several decades of wild industrial growth, financial manipulation, uncontrolled speculation and profiteering, it all collapsed. 642 banks failed, and 16,000 businesses closed down. Out of the labor force of 15 million, 3 million were unemployed. No state government voted relief, but mass demonstrations all over the country forced city governments to set up soup kitchens and give people work on streets or parks. In New York City, in Union Square, Emma Goldman addressed a huge meeting of the unemployed and urged those whose children needed food to go into the stores and take it. She was arrested for inciting to riot and sentenced to 2 years in prison. In Chicago, it was estimated that 200,000 people were without work. The floors and stairways of City Hall and the police stations packed every night with homeless men trying to sleep. The Depression lasted for years and brought a wave of strikes throughout the country. The largest of these was the nationwide strike of railroad workers in 1894 that began at the Pullman Company in Illinois, just outside of Chicago. Annual wages of railroad workers, according to the report of the Commissioner of Labor in 1890, were $957 for engineers, the aristocrats of the railroad, but $570 for conductors, $212 for brakemen, and $124 for laborers. Railroad work was one of the most dangerous jobs in America. Over 2,000 railroad workers were being killed each year, and 30,000 injured. The railroad companies called these acts of God or the result of carelessness on the part of the workers. But the Locomotive Firemen's Magazine said, "It comes to this. While railroad managers reduce their force and require men to do double duty, involving loss of rest and sleep, the accidents are chargeable to the greed of the corporation." It was the Depression of 1893 that propelled Eugene Debs into a lifetime of action for unionism and socialism. Debs was from Terre Haute, Indiana, where his father and mother ran a store. He had worked on the railroads for 4 years until he was 19, but left when a friend was killed after falling under a locomotive. He came back to join a railroad brotherhood as a billing clerk. At the time of the great strikes of 1877, Debs opposed them and argued there was no necessary conflict between capital and labor. But when he read Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, it deeply affected him. He followed the events at Homestead, Coeur d'Alene, the Buffalo Switchman strike, and wrote, "If the year 1892 taught the working men any lesson worthy of heed, it was that the capitalist class, like a devilfish, had grasped them with its tentacles and was dragging them down to fathomless depths of degradation. To escape the prehensile clutch of these monsters constitutes a standing challenge to organized labor for 1893. In the midst of the economic crisis of 1893, a small group of railroad workers, including Debs, formed the American Railway Union to unite all railway workers. Debs said, "A life purpose of mine has been the federation of railroad employees. To unify them into one great body is my object. Class enrollment fosters class prejudices and class selfishness. It has been my life's desire to unify railroad employees and to eliminate the aristocracy of labor and organize them so all will be on an equality." Knights of Labor people came in, virtually merging the old knights with the American Railway Union, according to labor historian David Montgomery. Debs wanted to include everyone, but blacks were kept out. At a convention in 1894, the provision in the Constitution barring blacks was affirmed by a vote of 112 to 100. Later, Debs thought this might have had a crucial effect on the outcome of the Pullman strike, for black workers were in no mood to cooperate with the strikers. In June 1894, workers at the Pullman Palace Car Company went on strike. One can get an idea of the kind of support they got, mostly from the immediate vicinity of Chicago in the first months of the strike, from a list of contributions put together by the Reverend William H. Cowardine, a Methodist pastor in the company town of Pullman for 3 years. He was sent away after he supported the strikers. Typographical Union, number 16. Painters and Decorators Union, number 147. Carpenters Union, number 23. 24th Ward Republican Club. Grand Crossing Police. Hyde Park Water Department. Picnic at Gardner's Park. Milk Dealers Union. Hyde Park Liquor Dealers. 14th Precinct Police Station. Swedish Concert. Chicago Fire Department. German Singing Society. Check from Anaconda, Montana. The Pullman strikers appealed to a convention of the American Railway Union for support. Mr. President and brothers of the American Railway Union, we struck at Pullman because we were without hope. We joined the American Railway Union because it gave us a glimmer of hope. 20,000 souls, men, women, and little ones, have their eyes turned toward this convention today, straining eagerly through dark despondency for a glimmer of the heaven-sent message you alone can give us on this earth. You all must know that the proximate cause of our strike was the discharge of 2 members of our grievance committee. 5 reductions in wages, the last was the most severe, amounting to nearly 30%, and rents had not fallen. Water, which Pullman buys from the city at 8 cents a thousand gallons, he retails to us at 500% advance. Gas, which sells at 75 cents per thousand feet in Hyde Park, just north of us, he sells for $2.25. When we went to tell him our grievances, he said we were all his children. Pullman, both the man and the town, is an ulcer on the body politic. He owns the houses, the schoolhouses, and churches of God in the town he gave his once humble name. And thus the merry war, the dance of skeletons bathed in human tears, goes on, and it will go on, brothers, forever, unless you, the American Railway Union, stop it, end it, crush it out. The American Railway Union responded. It asked its members all over the country not to handle Pullman cars. Since virtually all passenger trains had Pullman cars, this amounted to a boycott of all trains, a nationwide strike. Soon, all traffic on the 24 railroad lines leading out of Chicago had come to a halt. Workers derailed freight cars, blocked tracks, pulled engineers off trains if they refused to cooperate. The General Managers Association, representing the railroad owners, agreed to pay 2,000 deputies sent in to break the strike. But the strike went on. The Attorney General of the United States, Richard Olney, a former railroad lawyer, now got a court injunction against blocking trains on the legal ground that the federal mails were being interfered with. When the strikers ignored the injunction, President Cleveland ordered federal troops to Chicago. On July 6, hundreds of cars were burned by strikers. The following day, the state militia moved in, and the Chicago Times reported on what followed. Company C, 2nd Regiment, disciplined a mob of rioters yesterday afternoon at 49th and Loomis Streets. The police assisted and finished the job. There is no means of knowing how many rioters were killed or wounded. The mob carried off many of its dying and injured. A crowd of 5,000 gathered. Rocks were thrown at the militia, and the command was given to fire. To say that the mob went wild is but a weak expression. The command to charge was given. From that moment, only bayonets were used. A dozen men in the front line of rioters received bayonet wounds. Tearing up cobblestones, the mob made a determined charge. The word was passed along the line for each officer to take care of himself. One by one, as occasion demanded, they fired point blank into the crowd. The police followed with their clubs. A wire fence enclosed the track. The rioters had forgotten it. When they turned to fly, they were caught in a trap. The police were not inclined to be merciful, and driving the mob against the barbed wires, clubbed it unmercifully. The crowd outside the fence rallied to the assistance of the rioters. The shower of stones was incessant. The ground over which the fight had occurred was like a battlefield. The men shot by the troops and police lay about like logs. In Chicago that day, 13 people were killed, 53 seriously wounded, 700 arrested. Before the strike was over, perhaps 34 were dead. With 14,000 police, militia, troops in Chicago, the strike was crushed. Debs was arrested for contempt of court, for violating the injunction that said he could not do or say anything to carry on the strike. He told the court, "It seems to me that if it were not for resistance to degrading conditions, the tendency of our whole civilization would be downward. After a while, we would reach the point where there would be no resistance and slavery would come." Debs, in court, denied he was a socialist. But during his 6 months in prison, he studied socialism and talked to fellow prisoners who were socialists. Later he wrote, "I was to be baptized in socialism, in the roar of conflict, in the gleam of every bayonet, in the flash of every rifle the class struggle was revealed. This was my first practical struggle in socialism." 2 years after he came out of prison, Debs wrote in the Railway Times, "The issue is socialism versus capitalism. I am for socialism because I am for humanity. We have been cursed with the reign of gold long enough. Money constitutes no proper basis of civilization. The time has come to regenerate society. We are on the eve of a universal change." Thus, the 80s and 90s saw bursts of labor insurrection more organized than the spontaneous strikes of 1877. There were now revolutionary movements influencing labor struggles, the ideas of socialism affecting labor leaders. Radical literature was appearing, speaking of fundamental changes, of new possibilities for living. In this same period, those who worked on the land, farmers, North and South, black and white, were going far beyond the scattered tenant protests of the pre-Civil War years and creating the greatest movement of agrarian rebellion the country had ever seen. When the Homestead Act was being discussed in Congress in 1860, a senator from Wisconsin said he supported it. "Because its benign operation will postpone for centuries, if it will not forever, all serious conflict between capital and labor in the older free states, withdrawing their surplus population to create in greater abundance the means of subsistence." The Homestead Act did not have that effect. It did not bring tranquility to the East by moving Americans to the West. It was not a safety valve for discontent, which was too great to be contained that way. As Henry Nash Smith says, "Virgin land," and as we have seen. On the contrary, the 3 decades following its passage were marked by the most bitter and widespread labor trouble that had yet been seen in the United States. It also failed to bring peace to the farm country of the West. Hamlin Garland, who had made so many Americans aware of the life of the farmer, wrote in the preface to his novel, Jason Edwards, "Free land is gone. The last acre of available farmland has now passed into private or corporate hands." In Jason Edwards, a Boston mechanic takes his family west, drawn by advertising circulars. But he finds that all land within 30 miles of a railroad has been taken up by speculators. He struggles for 5 years to pay off a loan and get title to his farm, and then a storm destroys his wheat just before harvest. Behind the despair so often registered in the farm country literature of that day, there must have been visions from time to time of a different way to live. In another Garland novel, A Spoil of Office, the heroine speaks at a farmer's picnic. I see a time when the farmer will not need to live in a cabin on a lonely farm. I see the farmers coming together in groups. I see them with time to read and time to visit with their fellows. I see them enjoying lectures in beautiful halls,